So, who would like to ask? Yes, at the back there, Patricia.
Bishop, can you venture any explanation for the, to me, inexplicable teaming up of radical Islamism and aggressive secularism? They seem, on the face of it, strange bedfellows.
Yes, I mean, this has fascinated me. I think from the point of view of aggressive secularism, the reason is that in the West, anyway, Christianity is really the only serious ideological rival of aggressive secularism. So other views can be accommodated and indeed used to promote the secularist agenda. So for instance, it is quite often said, you mustn't celebrate Christian festivals publicly because that will offend people of other faiths, when in fact people of other faiths are not at all offended by the celebration of Christian festivals. So I think it's that kind of thing. Now, from the radical Islamist point of view, secularism provides them with the space that they need so that if there is no common moral or spiritual discourse, then any radical ideology can make better headway. I think that's the...
Thank you very much, Bishop. I really enjoyed the history of the rise of secularism. But one of the difficulties I often face is I think secularism in this country is often put across as a neutral option rather than an anti-religious option or whatever. Just to give you a small example, there's a senator at the moment. There's a prayer said at the beginning of the meeting in the Senate. And there's a senator who has brought in addition to the prayer, a minute of silence. She now wants to move to just the silence. So in actual fact, what she wants to do is silence everybody except her own ideals.
Yes.
But it's presented as a neutral stance.
Yes.
Without going through the whole history of the rise of secularism, how do you, in a nutshell, show that actually what she's doing is anything but neutral?
Well, I think you've shown it excellently just now. But, I mean, I think that is the point, isn't it? That secularism is a worldview. It is it's a view of the universe, of the human condition, and the proposals that they bring forward arise from that worldview, as indeed they must. But the question that a nation has to face, whether it's Britain or whether it's Ireland, is whether they want that worldview to prevail or the Judeo-Christian. The choice is not between a worldview and no worldview. The choice is between this or that. And that is where they are desperate to make sure that people don't see that theirs is as much a worldview as the Christian. Now, in this, there are some unlikely allies. People like Richard Dawkins, for instance, or Peter Atkins, because they expose the fact that secularism is actually a worldview. And it needs to be taken into account, and you either agree with it or disagree with it. But it's not, as it were, a neutral vantage. There is no neutral vantage point, in other words.
Historically, in Britain and indeed Europe, Marxism and socialism were countered in most parts by the rise of evangelicalism.
Yeah.
Do you see that aggressive secularism can be countered without the reconversion of society? Should we as Christians try and argue our case, argue our point, or should we focus on transforming those around us?
Yes, I mean, this is a very difficult question to answer. At the last general election, I was part of a campaign to go to different constituencies and to gather the Christian community around the parliamentary candidates so that the Christian community could interact with them and hear them out, but also to ask them questions about what they intended to do if and once they got to Parliament. Now, a number of clergy and other church leaders said to me, they said, well, well done, Bishop, you know, you go and do this, and we are behind you and we are praying for you, but it's not something we want to do, because our task is to bring people to faith in Jesus Christ. Our task is to build up people in the Christian life and so on. You know, we don't want to enter this rather messy world of politics. I mean, I respect that, but then, of course, you leave the public arena to the wolves. You evacuate it of any kind of Christian witness, of any kind of accountability, and this is the reason why Christians are invisible, of course. I mean, in Britain, the most invisible group is the Christian. Everyone else has a list of demands, everyone else knows what to do, but the Christians don't for these reasons. Now, of course, we must bring people to faith, strengthen them in the faith, build them up in the Christian life, but I don't think that is necessarily opposed to active participation in public life, because the God who is the God of the church is also the God of the world, who has made the world and who has ordered the nations and their lives by his graciousness, and who wills that people should live in the way that he wants them to live. I mean, this is, you know, when we talk about the common good, for instance, what we are saying is that there is a particular way of living that is good for society, is good for the nation, it's good for the world. And I don't think those two are necessarily opposed, but I know that a lot of people think that they are. The evangelicals whom you mentioned in the 18th and 19th centuries never made that distinction. I mean, they were constantly trying to renew the moral and spiritual life of people whilst actively also participating in public life, for example, in things like the campaign for the abolition of the slave trade, industrial relationships, industrial law, and all of these things, and then we should learn from them.
Thank you very much, Bishop, for your very interesting talk. Just when you speak about aggressive secularism and even procedural secularism, I wonder if it's kind of misleading in a sense that it implies that there's a non-aggressive type of secularism, whereas it's a little bit, I think, like speaking about sweet sugar or wet water. And that kind of raises questions about whether it's even possible for coexistence between the Christian and the secularist viewpoints in a society. And just another point, I'm putting that to you as a point, and just the other point is that we speak about secularist, excuse me, as though they were other than ourselves. Whereas I think to a large extent, the problem for us, at least in Ireland, and I think elsewhere, is that the church itself has become extremely secularized. And the thinking of people, Maria there mentioned, you know, she put the case there, how do you oppose that particular view? But, I mean, a lot of people would have great difficulty opposing it because it sounds so plausible, the senator and the moment of prayer. It sounds so plausible, and people haven't got the resources to oppose it. And, I mean, many of the church institutions have become thoroughly secularized, not just in their behavior, but in their very thinking. And where do we even begin to oppose? Thank you.
Yes, I think the second one, the second part of your question, Father, is easier to answer, perhaps. I mean, I think it's absolutely right that the churches have become secularized. And this is part of the general disenchantment. I mean, they participate in... So we don't really believe in the sacred, even though quite often we say that we do, whether that's sacredness of time or place or the Word of God or the sacraments. I mean, we've become secular in our outlook. There has to be constant teaching. Catechizing is a word that comes to mind, to make people aware of what has happened. I mean, it's like fish in the water. I mean, they live in this all the time, and the secularist assumptions are constantly reinforced, whereas the Christian ones are constantly challenged. Whether there is a non-aggressive secularism, I think that there probably is. I mean, I don't think all people who are secular are aggressive in the sense of preventing prayer in councils or in parliament or whatever, or in terms of closing down Catholic adoption agencies, or in terms of making sure that people who are not prepared to perform civil partnership ceremonies that they lose their jobs. I mean, there are people with secular views who do not want to impose their opinions on other people. But there are significant numbers of aggressive secularists who wish to do so. I mean, Richard Dawkins is clearly an example of such radical secularism, who wishes to impose a worldview on national life in the name of a public understanding of science. There are many scientists who probably share his worldview but don't want to impose it on others. So I think that's one kind of thing. The other is that the word secular is used differently in other parts of the world. I mean, we can't forget that. So in India, the term secular doesn't at all mean what it means in the West. It means a state that is not a state where different faiths can contribute to policy making. Now, in India, this is very important, of course, because next door to India is a state that is entirely ideological and does not believe that different faiths can contribute to policy making. So there's a slightly different use of the term secular. I would hate to admit... Perhaps you're right, but I would hate to admit that there are no secularists at all who are not aggressive. But maybe I'm wrong on that.
Okay, two more questions.
Do you think that there's a Freemasonry element involved in aggressive secularism?
Well, there are all sorts of elements. I mean, Freemasonry, of course, was an attempt to re-enchant a secularizing world. I mean, on the basis of, you know, some entirely spurious appeals to antiquity and so forth. I'm not sure if Freemasonry is an element in secularism. It certainly is an element in society in Britain, a very significant element. Personally, I have always believed, and I know that this is the Catholic Church's teaching as well, that Freemasonry, whether its members know it or not, is incompatible with Christianity. But if you say this in public, in Britain, for instance, I mean, the wrath of the gods comes down on you. And, you know, I mean, this has happened to me. Why it should do so, I don't know, because if you read particularly about the higher stages of Freemasonry, it is quite clear that it's a syncretistic system. It has had a baleful influence, I think I would have to say, on British public life. Whether it's overtly secular, I don't think I could say that. But there are other elements. I mean, the radical gay lobby is a very serious element because they see the radical gay agenda developing along with radical aggressive secularism. And at the very least, they're allies, if not the same people, in many respects.
Final question.
No, thank you. One thing I just wanted to perhaps bring up was secularism masquerading as liberalism. Now, it strikes me that this is perhaps one of the most insidious forms of secularism because it's kind of touchy-feely and seems to be very nice. And the other thing that struck me during your talk was you mentioned, a lot of times you mentioned moral and spiritual. The question really is it possible to have morality without spirituality? Are they not really completely intertwined?
Well, indeed, yes, absolutely. This is why I mentioned them together, because they are.
Are people not dissociating themselves, the two now, particularly in the secular sense, where they think you can have morality without spirituality?
Yes, indeed. And I think they are mistaken in this because, as I was trying to say, a moral point of view arises from a spiritual worldview. I mean, I was talking to quite an aggressive secularist the other day, and it is of course true that people who have no religious beliefs can be moral beings. I mean, we don't deny that at all. However, if you look at human history, all the great moral systems in the world have arisen in a religious context, whatever you think of them. I mean, whether that's the Torah of Israel or the laws of Manu of Hinduism or the Sharia of Islam or the canon law of the church, they've all arisen in a religious context. It is very difficult, you know, people can behave morally, but whether you could have a moral system without a religious basis, I don't think it's ever been done. So that's true. I mean, where liberalism is concerned, I think that there is a problem with liberalism itself. It's not just that the word liberal is being misused, though that is true. I mean, the most illiberal people these days in Britain are people who call themselves liberal. I mean, Lynn Featherston, the Equalities Minister, comes to mind. But I mean, I think it's worse than that. I think that, for instance, the influence of Jeremy Bentham on lawmaking in Britain is pervasive, which is that the law is the law, and the denial that morality is higher than the law. Well, you know, that's quite a common liberal position that's taken by lawyers in Britain today. And even by some religious leaders, I'm sorry to say. John Stuart Mill and the kind of sophisticated utilitarianism that he promoted is classically liberal, but is not enough, for example, to uphold the status of the human embryo or fetus, or indeed we may find of the older person who's near death. So I think there's something about liberalism that itself has to be challenged. The Syllabus of Errors, of course, had set itself against liberalism, I think, for these sorts of reasons. And the reasons will become more apparent as liberalism becomes more dominant.
Okay, so thank you, Bishop Michael. And just to add a couple of things on the point about secular neutrality, or the supposed neutrality of secularism. I mean, just today, in that madhouse called Twitter, and if you're not familiar, you're better off not being familiar with it. I tweeted about the fact that North Carolina, which was, by the way, a swing state and voted for Obama in 2008, had voted resoundingly against same-sex marriage by 61 to 39. So, of course, this set them off on Twitter and all kinds of accusations were being made and so on. But anyway, one person quotes back, and I know this guy's an atheist because I've encountered him on Twitter before, that he quotes Martin Luther King Jr. saying that in a moral universe, in the long run, justice will out. In a moral universe, in the long run, justice will out. And actually, this is a very curious quote coming from somebody who believes that the universe has no ultimate purpose at all, let alone a moral purpose. And so you see, this is what the bishop was saying about smuggling. They can't help at some level drawing on the kind of moral arguments that Christianity originally gave rise to in the West. And it's a matter of kind of catching them in the act. Okay, hang on a minute. Where are you getting that notion from? Okay, and say that's a Christian notion, or at least a religious notion, ultimately. Okay, and then this idea, you know, secularism, again, pretending to be neutral. Secularism in its present guise often is also, you know, it has a particular view of equality, but it won't allow anybody else to have any other view of equality. So if you take, you know, the case of the Catholic adoption agencies, suddenly the only way to promote equality is to pretend that two men or two women are the same as a man and a woman when it comes to raising children. Okay, you're not allowed to say that I think there's added value in a child being raised by a loving mother and father as distinct from two loving fathers or two loving mothers, as the case may be. You're not allowed to say this. You must shut up. You must close down. Okay, and this in the name of neutrality. It's such a load of total baloney. Okay, so it's a matter of finding what is the moral statement they're making. There's always a moral statement in there somewhere, and the trick is to find it and catch them out in the act of making the moral statement. And not be neutral. It's impossible to be neutral. Every viewpoint has some moral viewpoint in there somewhere. So I'd just like to thank again Bishop Michael for his fantastic talk and taking all those questions.